They are the canaries in the mine of our environment, and they are dying. And they are dying to the extent the federal government is considering listing them as an endangered species. So we ask, what is killing the bees?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1049th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way up there in Elfin Cove who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I'm Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating and What Radio with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Hello, Jason.
It's a pleasure.
Jason, what do you think is killing the bees?
What's killing the bees? Well, you know, I have a couple of thoughts. Just briefly, I think, well, overall, I think it has to do with us being the humans. And there may be a couple of possibilities. The first coming to mind being GMOs, Monsanto. Another possibility I was thinking was maybe man-made climate change, but not the kind that usually is talked about. I'm thinking maybe weather modification.
Okay. Sound like my wife. Folks, there are the canaries in the mine of our environment, and they are dying. In the United States, domesticated bee populations have collapsed to a 50-year low and are continuing to collapse. So many bees are dying, in fact, that the federal government is considering listing some as protected species under the Endangered Species Act. Go ahead and try to build your apartment complex with that happening, oh my goodness. There are two kinds of popular theories as to why the populations of bees are collapsing. One of them is from the European Union, which points to the pesticides being poured out into the environment. And the union is even moving to ban the neonicotinoid pesticides that they believe is the cause. The United States, on the other hand, points to parasites such as the varroa mite, bacterial diseases like foul brood, and multiple species of viruses. Well, both theories, in fact, are just that. They're just theories. As of yet, no substantive reason has yet to be given and accepted as to why all the bees are disappearing. To give this thought due consideration, we must journey into the belly of the bees. And here to help us guide us, we have Hamutal Cohen. Did I get that right, Hamutal?
Yeah, that's right, Hamutal Cohen.
Hamutal Cohen. Hamutal is a natural sciences graduate student of the University of California, Santa Cruz. So welcome. Great to have you aboard. You're a bee lady.
I'm a bee lady.
Good. Now, do you keep bees yourself?
You know, in the past I have kept honeybees, but now I'm more interested in working with wild bees, which are harder to keep.
And because they're wild.
Because they're wild. So you have to attract them to your garden and then observe them instead.
Huh. Never thought of that before, but I would assume, you know, they would behave in a way similar to other wild critters that you try to domesticate. They would say, wait a minute, don't fence me in. And so there you are. So you're working with the University of California, Santa Cruz. You're a graduate student in natural sciences. What was it, do you remember, way back when you had this epiphany, like, oh, bees, it's in the belly of the bees?
Well, I think my interest in the microbial diversity inside of bees came when I started thinking about the diversity of wild bees. So there are 4,000 species of bees in North America. And as I learned more and more about the different species, I started to think about, okay, what makes these bees healthy? What gives them the ability to persist in our natural and city environments? And I became really interested in their health. And one of the constituents of health is the bee gut microbiome, which humans have as well.
Mm-hmm. That means they have three or four bacteria in their bellies, right? No?
No.
No?
So for humans, your genome is actually complemented by a lot of other DNA. Your cells are outnumbered 10 to 1 by foreign DNA. And the same goes for bees. Inside of their guts, they have a lot of different bacteria, protists, fungi, and they're responsible for their health. They help.
Yeah. So that's really hard for me to comprehend, that there are 10 times more of them in me than me in me. Is that basically what you're saying?
Yeah, I am. And humans get gut microbes from a few different sources. So
Starts with the mom.
When you're born and you pass through the womb and out into the world, you're inoculated with all these different bacteria. And if you're born in a hospital room or at home, you're going to have a different set of gut bacteria. If you're born vaginally or through a C-section, you're going to have a different set of gut bacteria. So my question is, do bees also have varied gut bacteria? And why might those variations exist?
Wow. And so that is the basis of your graduate studies at the University of California?
Yes, it is.
Uh-huh. And how do you go about studying the microbiome in the belly of a bee?
Well, the first thing I try to do is identify different landscapes where bees might exist. So we have bees on farms, and we have bees in cities. We have bees in diverse natural environments. So I work with bees from across these different environments and then collect them and look at their gut microbes using DNA sequencing.
And there's 4,000 species of bees. Does it make a difference as to what kind of bee you actually decided to look at, or do you look at them all?
So right now I'm working with one species of bee. It's called Osmia ligneria, or the blue orchard bee. And what makes this bee really special is that when it turns from an egg into a little larva and then into an adult, it lives inside this cocoon. And inside of the cocoon, its guts rearrange. And so when it's born, it's essentially born as a blank slate. And then it goes and visits flowers, collecting pollen and nectar for food. And as it collects pollen and nectar, it also collects microbes. So it collects viruses, RNA viruses, which could be harmful to its health. It might encounter protozoans or microsporidians. And then it also gets beneficial bacteria, sort of like probiotics from flowers. So in the same way that humans get probiotics from eating yogurt or kimchi, kombucha, bees also get probiotics. So this bee is a really useful bee to study how landscapes impart different kinds of microbes to organisms.
Because it really is like a chalkboard for its environment.
Yeah.
Everything that it experiences is written right there.
Exactly. The microbiome is almost like a fingerprint of environmental health in a way.
Wow. So how on earth do you look inside of bee's belly?
Well,
I mean, if you're a scientist, you're going, I'm going to look at the microbiome of a bee. Well, this isn't a very big bee.
No, that's a good question. And in the simplest way, what it really involves is just mashing up bee guts. So you dissect the bee, you pull out the guts, and you mash it up. And after you extract the DNA using a series of chemical steps, what we want to do is sequence the genomes of the microbes. But rather than sequencing the entire genome of every single microbe, because there's so many in the gut.
How many? Like 10 million?
Yes, millions. We use sequence markers. So bacteria have a special sequence of DNA called the 16S sequence that the bee doesn't have. And those sequences are specific to different species of bacteria. And so after you get all the sequences of that 16S region, you can compare it to known sequences in these big databases of sequences that we have.
So crunching numbers, like crunching a lot of numbers.
Yeah, it requires a lot of computer software and coding to figure it out.
Well, and what are you looking for on your tongue?
Well, one of my questions is, if I look at a bee from a really simple environment, maybe an urban city or a garden within an urban city that doesn't have a lot of flowers, is that bee gut going to be diverse? Is it going to have the right kind of bacteria that that bee needs to survive? So bees use microbes in a lot of different ways. Microbes are responsible for digestion. They provide nutrients for the bee, things like vitamins. They also could potentially impart resistance to some insecticides. And I want to know how the microbes are going to be different from bees from different landscapes.
Mm-hmm. And looking for trouble in the crunching the numbers then. Mm-hmm. Do you think, you know, whatever is attacking the bees could be attacking us? I mean, the colonies of bees are collapsing about the world. Everybody's scratching their head. Do you think whatever's attacking the bees could be attacking us?
Well, it's an interesting way to phrase the question. So what is really responsible for bee decline? You mentioned earlier that pesticides might be responsible.
But wait a minute. Don't give that answer right now because we have to take a quick break.
Okay.
And when we come back, we'll pursue this as we go about our day. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with Hamutal Cohen, Natural Sciences graduate student, UC Santa Cruz, and you. 831-479-1080. What do you think is killing the bees? Curious to know. 831-479-1080. And what is killing the bees? Could it have an impact on us? Do stay tuned.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Welcome back. Food Chain Radio Pro. What is killing the bees? What do you think? 831-479-1080. And, you know, there are two ways of looking at it. One, the European way, they say it's the pesticides we're putting on the environment. The Americans say, nah, it's probably the predators that are going after the bees. Well, both of these ways of looking at the world kind of look out at the things that are happening outside the bee. Today, we're heading inside the bee and looking at the belly, into the belly of the bee, at the world of its microbiome. And we're doing so with Hamutal Cohen, who is a natural sciences graduate student, University of California, Santa Cruz. And so before we move on, you know, it's always amazing to me to, you know, to ponder has somebody that's actually looking into the belly of a bee for the cause of such a huge problem. Who's paying your way in this effort to find the cause of this problem?
You know, actually, the public is paying my way. I'm currently conducting a crowdfunding campaign, and it's online, and anybody could go and check out my research and donate money, and in exchange they'll learn about what I'm doing and also get cool gifts and rewards.
There you go. Who typically pays for university studies? It's typically not crowdfunded, but when you're a graduate student, you have to be more clever than when you're a professor, right?
Exactly.
Maybe your professor didn't hear my comment on that. We'd be lucky. Okay, is there really a problem with colony collapse disorder? We hear a lot about it, but we see bees in the garden.
Yeah, so in 2015, the USDA put out a report that said 42% of all commercially managed colonies were lost in the previous year. And that's one of the highest numbers ever recorded for colony loss. And you mentioned that there are two perspectives on why bees are dying. And I would venture to say that there's really a third perspective. And the kind of consensus that scientists have who study bee decline is that bee decline is due to a number of stressors that all really interact with one another. And so there are pressures on bees like parasites, such as varroa mites. There are pathogens, so there are RNA viruses. There are fungal pathogens. The introduction of invasive species can actually introduce new diseases to bees. Habitat loss. Bees really rely on having certain types of habitat to live. And so as we cover our natural habitat with urban pavement, or as we convert natural land into farmland, bees can lose their habitat.
With 1,000 acres of soybeans, you know, not much of a smorgasbord for bees to eat out of there.
Exactly. So that's one of the other causes of bee decline is simplified pollen diets. So there was a study that showed that bees fed a diet of only one kind of pollen were actually sicker than bees who are fed a pollen of lots of different kinds of pollen. It impacted their ability to express genes related to immunity. And that makes sense. If you think about a human, if a human's only eating one type of food, they're going to feel sick. They need a diversity of foods on their plate, and so do bees.
So there it is, simple as that. But you're saying then it's not really one or another. It's a combination of both that most scientists are looking at.
Then. Exactly. So things like parasites, like varroa mites, can create wounds on the bee into which infections can then spread. Or the way that we manage bees, so the way that we move pollination hives around to different farms across the country can actually spread disease around. Or, for example, exposing bees to pesticides may not directly kill them, but it's going to greatly weaken them and make them more likely to be heavily impacted by viruses.
Well, here's what may be another reason. Let's go to the phones right now, 831-479-1080. We have WC on the line. Welcome aboard, WC. You're talking with Hamital Koa and Michael Olson. Fire away.
I was considering the possibility for a while, other than different types of foods not being done, but the inbreeding of the colonies weakens them also.
Oh, a little bit of disagreement here. Go ahead, Hamital. Does inbreeding not, we know that it kind of messes up people.
Well, I think you bring up a good point. And so what a lot of people don't realize is that we have been working with honeybees for so long that there's actually a huge industry around beekeeping and pollination services. There's actually regulations about the international trade of bee semen for honeybee production.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
No, never mind.
But we don't know if this has resulted in changes in genetic diversity of the honeybee and if subsequently that impacts their ability to persist. And so some wild colonies of honeybees may be more resistant to diseases, but that hasn't really been proven or shown from a scientific perspective.
In your having worked with bees, what is the difference in the behavioral characteristic of how do they operate? The cultivated bee is trained, you know, by us over a long period of time to act in a certain way and do a certain job. What about wild bees?
Yeah, so honeybees have been domesticated over such a long period of time, and we've tended to really select for traits that make it easier to work with them. So we've made them more docile and more friendly to handle. Wild bees are actually not very likely to sting. They're pretty docile as well, but they have very, very different behaviors than honeybees. So honeybees are incredibly social. They live in these huge colonies, you know, up to 50,000 individuals, and they'll forage for pollen and nectar, and they're really, really good pollinators. But wild bees are really good pollinators as well. Even though they're solitary, they don't live in big colonies. They tend to just live with lay their offspring, and that's it.
So they build up their honey stash in their own place.
So wild bees actually don't build up honey the way that honeybees do. They'll still collect nectar and pollen for food, but they don't make honey.
Wow.
Yeah, so honeybees are just one species of the 4,000 species, and they're the only ones that make honey.
Okay, WC, you got a follow-up?
That's about it. I was thinking about the different types of foods and the inbreeding, because like with domestic dogs, you get the purebreds. They've been so bred that they end up being beautiful, but they also end up not having a lot of health problems and not surviving as long as a regular mutt would.
Well, there you go. And it's an interesting thought. Thank you very much for thinking it here on the Food Chain Radio Program, WC. 831-479-1080 is the phone number today. That's kind of interesting, though, when you think about it, because we really, you know, honeybees are great friends. And, you know, we've worked with them for a long, long time, almost probably as long as dogs, maybe. What do you think? How long have we been working with honeybees?
What's interesting about honeybees is that they're not native to North America. They were actually introduced here. And so as honeybee populations have been declining, a lot of people have looked towards these wild bees and these native bees and said, maybe we should be focusing on conserving these bees instead as insurance against honeybee losses.
And that's why you're kind of looking at it. And again, you know, the reason you're looking at wild bees is because they're a better indicator of what's going on in the environment.
And also because wild bees are subject to the same diseases that honeybees are. So the same viruses and parasites that honeybees are getting, wild bees are getting as well. And we really need our wild bees. So especially bumblebees, we've been able to track, are hard hit. We're losing a lot of our bumblebee species.
Okay, so in fact, we are in deep trouble, aren't we? Is it true that bees are responsible for somewhere, our pollinators are responsible for 1/3 of the food we eat?
Yeah, exactly. 35% of all of the global crop production is dependent on insect pollination.
So they are the canaries in the mine of our environment. Is it fair? Is that a fair assessment?
I would say that we definitely should be alarmed that bee populations are declining.
Okay. And we're going to find out why, or we're going to try to find out why, by taking a journey into the belly of the bee when we get back with Hamutal Cohen, natural sciences graduate student, UCSC, and you, 831-479-1080. Well, folks, we are on the hunt of what's going on, what's killing the bees, and they are dying. And they are the indicator of the health of our environment because they're responsible for 35% of the food we eat. So if something is killing our bees, we should kind of lift up our head and say, what is killing our bees? A lot of folks looking outside in the outside world, they're looking at the various stressors, the predators, the pesticides, the cropping systems, all kinds of different reasons for what's could be killing the bees, but we don't really know what it is yet for sure. So today we're taking a trip into the belly of the bee. When we're doing so with Hamutal Cohen, with a PhD candidate in natural sciences at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And we're on the hunt for the reason of our bee decline. And we're hunting wild bees instead of our domesticated bees. And Hamutal has our own bee. And why did you select that bee again?
I'm really interested in learning about the microbiome of the blue orchard bee, because even though it's not a honeybee, it's actually really important for agriculture. A lot of farmers are currently trying to adapt the blue orchard bee for pollination of nut crops, especially almonds. And so they're being used in the Central Valley of California.
Are they domesticating them? Are they breeding them? Or
They're trying. They're hard to work with, and so they haven't really been bred or domesticated in the same way that honeybees have. So it's currently an experiment in process. People are trying to work with them, trying to see, could we use these bees commercially? And that's one of the reasons why I'm so interested in them, because they're potentially very important for food.
Okay, wow. Let's see. We've got Sean calling in with a question about wild bees. And as long as we're talking about wild bees, let's pick them up. Sean, welcome to the food chain.
I just wanted to have one question about wild bees. Aren't there wild hives or wild honeybees that are non-European? Or if you could answer that question.
No, that's a really good question. And sometimes I use the word wild and native interchangeably, but they're really two different things. So there are native bees and there are wild bees. So honeybees.
And there are domesticated bees.
And there are domesticated bees.
There's three kinds of bees.
Yeah, so honeybees are non-native, but they can be wild or domesticated. So you can have a domesticated honeybee that buds off into a swarm and then go lives in a environment outside of a farm, and then it's a wild colony. And so you're right, there are wild colonies of honeybees, and they're not necessarily native.
Good question.
But are there native Californian honeybees?
Yes, there are. Yeah. And so one of the things that my research group does is look at the diversity of bees in California. And what we found for the central coast of California is that there are 55 different species of bees, and some of these are native to this area. And every area within the U.S. is going to have some bees that are native to it.
So even... Even up in Elfin Cove, Alaska, they have native bees?
If there are plants, there are probably bees.
And they don't collect and store honey, so how do they survive winter?
Yeah, so what these bees do is in the spring, they emerge and they collect pollen and nectar, and they bring it to their offspring, they bring it to their eggs, and those eggs turn into larvae, and they use those provisions, but they spend most of the rest of the year in cocoons developing to adults. And they themselves will only emerge next spring. And so they're only adults on a kind of seasonal level.
Live for the season. Seize the day, right? Okay. Thank you very much, Sean. Appreciate your call.
Thank you.
Let's go to Rory. Rory, welcome to the food chain.
Well, thank you. And your guest has some fascinating research going on. Maybe you could, at the end of the show, let us know where to follow up on that.
Well,
progress.
Yeah, we certainly will do that. Yeah.
If you have it, be on the journal. Exciting. But just a quick question. I always notice in the spring here in the Pajaro Valley, even in Southern California, you've always got wild honeybee swarms. And first question is, have they been impacted by CDC? Is there any research known about that?
Yeah. So first, I'd like to say you can follow up on my research at tinyurl.com/beeguts.
Tinyurl.
tinyurl.com/beeguts.
Beeguts.
Thank you.
Yes. And the second thing I'd like to say is that, yes, wild colonies of honeybees are subject and do have the same kind of disease microbes as well as beneficial microbes that other bees have as well.
So they could have colony collapse disorder, except wild bees don't have colonies.
Well, wild honeybees
do.
Wild honeybees do.
Yeah.
Okay. Domesticated honeybees that have gone wild.
And we actually think that the way we've managed honeybees and moved them across the country has been responsible for some spread of disease, because disease can spread through flowers, through pollen vectors.
Sure, those mites, I'm sure the tracheal mites and the other mites are moving around. It is fascinating research, though, about the gut biota and how it impacts their health. The other thing, and you may have mentioned it, obviously the honeybee we have here is native of Europe, correct?
Yes.
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay, so there were no honeybees in North America. It was interesting. The other question I have for
you. Well, wait a minute. There were wild bees.
No, honeybees, is what
okay.
I said.
Okay, but the wild bees did not make honey.
Correct. Okay. And then there's a whole bombus species of bumblebees and how they're using them for pollination and greenhouse tomatoes. It's a whole fascinating other subject. But quick question. I heard from a reliable source that in Australia they don't have colony collapse disorder, and they're using a lot of the same neonics that are used here and in Europe. Have you heard that, and do you know anything about that?
You know, I honestly haven't heard anything about
I think that was a Bayer researcher, because, you know, all the chemical companies are careful about any new chemistry. They're doing a lot of research. Some of these companies have established bee research centers I think in one of the Carolinas. You may be aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, just curious. I've heard that, and so it might point to something else besides a neonic, which essentially the original chemistry came from the nicotine plant. So, just interesting. So,
Rory, one quick comment from Hanyo. Go ahead.
So, I think you brought up a couple of interesting points that I would love to explain. So, you mentioned bumblebees used in tomato greenhouses, and earlier I said that invasive species might be contributing to colony collapse. And that's one way in which invasive species have. And so bumblebees, like honeybees, have been domesticated, and farmers can rent or purchase bumblebee colonies and use them for pollination. And they're used for tomatoes because bumblebees are really good at pollinating tomatoes. And farmers will move non-native species of bumblebees to different areas, and those bumblebees have often escaped and then spread diseases to wild populations.
Now, has that been shown?
Yes.
Happened? Because I know they can only use them in the greenhouse or in enclosures.
Yes, but what happens is usually those greenhouses will have little holes in them, and the bumblebees will escape. And so a non-native species of bumblebee can then spread diseases to wild local bumblebee species.
There you go. Roy, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
You bet. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. We will go on a journey into the belly of the bee when we get back. And I'm not going to miss out on this one. Food Chain Radio Program, Michael Olson with Hamut Hall Cohen, Natural Sciences. You, 831-479-1080. Well, can we learn what's killing the bees by looking into the belly of the bees? That's the question on the table today. And with us, we have a person who's actually looking into the belly of the bees, Hamut Hall Cohen. How on earth do we go about doing this? You start with your favorite wild bee. You pick this bee because it starts out as a blank slate, and it doesn't have, it has not collected any DNA information, so it's a blank slate. But how do you go about, examining the all of those trillions and billions and zillions of little tiny buggies that's inside the belly of a bee?
You know, that's a good question. As a scientist, I have to be really preoccupied and concerned with making sure I have a sound experimental design. And so I have a series of field sites.
Is that what professors do?
That's what they tell me to do.
Okay.
I have a series of field sites, 18 sites, and they're all urban gardens. And they differ in terms of their landscape. And those differences allow me to ask the question, how would habitat and landscape differences impact or make the bee microbiome vary? So some of my gardens are surrounded by really, really urban landscape, but some are actually surrounded by agriculture and others by more natural forested habitat. And then the gardens themselves can kind of be characterized as either really simple with only a few species or more complex with a lot of species of plants. And so what I have to do is actually measure all the vegetation, all the plants, all the soil, all the trees in every single garden. And then I also do it around the gardens as well, using special software that helps me characterize the different kinds of land cover around each garden. Okay, so I have these sites. They're all different. I know how they're different. And then I need to figure out how are the microbiomes of the bees inside each site different, and how might the vegetation be correlated with those differences.
What are you hunting for?
I am actually placing the bees out myself. So I'm not going there and looking for them. I'm putting them out. I'm installing them at every single site. And then I return to each site after the bees have had a chance to live there. And then I collect them, and then I do DNA sequencing on them to look at how their microbiomes might differ. So I look at how the different genomes inside of the bee, the foreign genomes of bacteria and fungi and protists, differ between the different sites.
And what are you looking for there? You're going to take, that's a lot of information, about 49 trillion pieces of information or something?
Yeah, so I want to know, are there more species of bacteria in diverse sites? But one of the challenges that we have is that we don't actually know if a more diverse microbiome, if a microbiome made up of lots and lots of different species, is actually better. Because these bacteria have different roles. And so there's different kinds of diversity, maybe functionally, maybe the actual actions and roles of each microbe is more important than just, you know, the absolute number of microbes in the gut. So those are some of the things I'm trying to parse out. And then I'm also looking at the diseases that these bees have. I'm looking at the number of viruses they have and the number of parasites, and I'm going to compare it with the diversity of microbes. So wow. I'll actually be able to hopefully find out if they have a more diverse microbiome, are they healthier?
And we were talking a little bit about this earlier, perhaps off the air, about how the diversity, we were on the air, we were talking about the diversity of diet and how a bee that has to live on 10,000 acres of soybeans might not have an immune system as strong as a bee that lives on a whole bunch of different kinds of pollens.
That's definitely
true. So it's kind of the same, it's the same kind of thinking, isn't it, Dan?
Yeah, it definitely is. And so I often like to think about humans. Human microbiomes will change with time. So from baby to adulthood, the human microbiome evolves and changes as you eat different things and as you live in different places, or even as you take medicine like antibiotics. And so the same goes for bees. My thinking is if a bee is only eating a few different kinds of crops, they might not have the same kind of microbiome as a bee that's getting food from lots and lots of different crops.
Well, good. In that regard, we have a question about antibiotics from Jim. Jim, welcome to the Food Chain Radio program. You're talking with Hamutal Cohen. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning, Michael. Yeah, I was wondering if your guest had any thoughts about the trend to feed bees antibiotics for their various diseases that they have, and how that might affect the microflora of their bee guts.
Such a great question. So the way that antibiotics work is by attacking parts of bacteria that humans, or in this case bees, don't have. So bacteria have cell walls, whereas bees and humans, our cells don't have cell walls. And so antibiotics like penicillin will impact the ability of bacteria to make those cell walls. But they're not very discriminatory, and so they'll kill a lot of different kinds of bacteria. So if you're really, really sick, antibiotics can help you, but they're going to basically destroy your gut flora, which you can, you know, in some capacity rebuild. But every time you take antibiotics, there's some microbes you might never get back. And so when bees are treated with antibiotics, we don't really know if that's destroying their gut flora and what the consequences are to their subsequent ability to fight disease.
Great question, Jim. Thank you very much. Folks, you bet. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host. Hamutal Cohen, when we get back, we're going to ask what we can do as humans to help the bees help us. Because without the bees, we're going to have over a third less food to eat, which would put us all in a big pickle. Well, wait a minute. We wouldn't have pickles, would we? We wouldn't, would
we? That's right. Cucumbers are pollinated by bees.
Well, we couldn't even be in it. We'd be in such a bad fix, we wouldn't even have pickles to eat. So do stay tuned. Right back. Few minutes left. So much to talk about. Welcome back, folks. Few minutes left. We're going to talk about what we as human beings can do to better take care of our bees. But we have a problem there because we don't really know what we're doing wrong. Do we, Hamutal?
I think that there's so many different causes of bee decline that it's hard to know where to start. But one place where I think we should start is looking at how we manage honeybees. You know, because we manage honeybees on such large scale levels, we're moving hives, millions of hives all over the country every year to pollinate our crops. That might be one place to start and think, okay, how might this be impacting bees?
Well, it's obvious that it's impacting bees, but what do you do about it? Because you need to move those hives around. Is there a way perhaps of, you know, cultivating a local bee population that would be sufficient to do that? But then, you know, the blossoms come and the blossoms go, and then what do you do with all the local bees?
So that's something I'm hoping to show with my research. If I find that having a diversity of crops is really beneficial to bee health, that might help support the idea that polycultures and diverse farming systems are good for bees. And maybe I won't find that, but I think we all kind of agree that diversity of crops is good for bees because eating a lot of different kinds of food is good for them.
And I guess that brings in all the other related issues with respect to the industrial scale agriculture. We use a lot of chemicals that probably are not too helpful to bees or other living things because that's what they're designed not to be.
Exactly. So things like insecticides and herbicides can really impact bees on a physiological level. So the chemical components of herbicides can change the way that bees remember and really negatively impact their ability to forage for food.
Okay. Yeah. Now, can what is happening to bees be happening to people?
Well, golly. So one of the things that you can think about, I guess, with regards to pesticide exposure is pesticide exposure to humans, but not just the everyday human, but farm workers as well. So if you think about who's on a farm, you have your bees moving around and you have people, you have farm workers, and those are the people who are directly in contact with pesticides and herbicides. Right. So I think, you know, if we want to advocate for bees, we should be advocating for the other workers on the farm as well.
Okay, just go ahead.
Can you please tell us what we can do in our gardens to support bee populations?
Yeah, so the everyday person can actually do a lot to support bees. So you can learn about bees, and then you can try to foster bee communities in your own hometown. There are certain plants that bees prefer. Native bees tend to prefer native plants. So find out what are the native plants in your area and incorporate some into your garden. Now, there's also some ornamental crops and fruit crops that bees really like. They love plants in the group asters, so sunflowers and cosmos. They love borage, things in the borage family. They love things in the rosaceae family, which is roses and apples. So you can plant those things for your bees. One thing you want to consider is the seasonality of bloom. So if everything in your garden is blooming in early spring, what are bees going to eat in the summer? So as you plan your garden, you want to keep track of bloom times and think, okay, I want something to be blooming in the spring, something in the summer, something in the fall, and ideally something in the winter as well.
So if you have 1,000 acres of soybeans, then they all blossom at the same time and then there's nothing.
That's what we call a temporal glut of food, and that might not be the best thing for bees.
Well, that's what I do sometimes, too, when I get too hungry. I have a temporal glut of food. Folks, thank you very much for tuning in. Hamutal Cohen, thank you. So what's your website again?
My website is tinyurl.com/beeguts.
Beeguts.
Beeguts.
Thank you all for tuning in. I guess this will file this one under the first law of the food chain. Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.